Hello and welcome to Asia in Depth. I'm Tom Nagorski. Today we return to the coronavirus for an update on the outbreak and a special look at where it all began. Until recently, a lot of people may never have heard of Wuhan, but it's a huge and important city in central China. More than 11 million people live there. And as is very well known now, it was in Wuhan that cases of pneumonia flared just a little over a month ago, the beginnings of an outbreak that has now infected more than 20,000 people, more than 400 of whom have died. Before we get to Wuhan, these important updates. 1 week ago, we spoke to Dr. Thomas Inglesby, director of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, who told us there were two fundamental metrics to watch as information emerged from inside China. First, the rate of spread. Second, the rate of fatalities. Well, we have fresh evidence now that the rate of spread is high, comparable, Dr. Inglesby and others are saying, to influenza, the flu. In the last week alone, the number of cases has tripled. The virus has been detected in more than 24 countries, though important to note that more than 99% of the reported cases are in China. This coronavirus is, in the language of public health officials, an efficient traveler. As for the fatality rate, there may at least be some encouraging news there. The death rate for the coronavirus outbreak stands at about 2%, and it is falling. As the experts have told us, it's common for the death rate to drop, as typically the more severe cases are seen earlier on. By way of comparison, the death rate for the SARS outbreak in 2003 was much higher, above 10%. Now, there's a big caveat here. Anecdotal reports from inside Wuhan suggest that some people have become ill and may even have died without ever reaching a hospital. So there may well have been deaths that have gone unreported. In the meantime, China continues to clamp down on travel, particularly inside Wuhan, and many countries and air carriers have now shut down all travel to China. It's hard to fathom what the shutdown of a city of 11 million people is like, what it means for residents, the vast majority of whom remain healthy. Muyi Xiao is the visuals editor for the Asia Society publication Chinafile. She's from Wuhan. Her parents still live there. From day one, Muyi, here in New York, has been gathering information from family and friends in Wuhan. She's watching and trying to learn everything she can about the outbreak and how it's affecting people in the place she calls home. Muyi spoke with the editor of Chinafile, Susan Jakes. Jakes reported on the SARS outbreak from China for Time magazine.
Let's start at the very beginning. How and when did you first begin to become aware that the new sickness that we now call 2019 nCoV or 2019 novel coronavirus was infecting people in Wuhan?
I remember it was December 30th, and I was actually at my husband's home and we were waiting for the new year to come. And then a close friend in China who's in China, but who lives in Shanghai, he sent me a screenshot of a Douban post, a post on Douban, which is a Chinese social media. And the post is about these people in this group chat talking about, like several cases of SARS-like virus infected patients found in hospitals. And, the friend is a very good journalist and he works at Chinese media. So I thought, if he got alerted, then I should too. So I just immediately sent that message to my parents as well and called them to see if they heard anything, and also my uncle is a doctor. I asked them if they heard anything from my uncle. So that's when I first heard about this thing.
And what had they heard? Had your parents heard anything? Had your uncle heard anything?
At that time, my parents have not talked to my uncle yet, which was, December 30th. But they have heard something. They've seen the same post in their own, community group chat because, they're in Wuhan and there are people around them talk about it already. So they heard about it, but they said they will be careful, but they don't seem to be that alerted. So we talked about it and they were just telling me that they will keep it in mind. And I told them to try to not to go to, place that are crowded. And they actually followed that in the following days.
They followed your advice.
Yeah, they followed my advice. Like, they didn't go to anything too crowded. And also, like, I checked with them if they have any masks at home. And I, you know, previously, every time when I went back to Wuhan, I actually kept a lot of masks for pollution. So we've had a lot of, like, the anti-pollution masks, which works for just, like, daily life, you know, prevent the virus. So they had a lot of stuff in stock at home.
But then we reach the 22nd of January. I had actually just landed in Hong Kong then, and the news suddenly broke that Wuhan was going to be completely locked down, that people living there wouldn't be allowed to travel. And all of a sudden, this rush of information started pouring out onto social media and into the press that suggested a far larger outbreak. What were your communications with your parents like that day?
I was I called them very early in the morning in their time, because I want to just wake them up to let them go get some, you know, food in stock. Because I told them, you know, if you go to the supermarket late, then people all the food might already run out. I messaged them when the news first came out. I think that was like around 2 p.m. Like it's our afternoon in the U.S. as in their midnight. And I messaged them, and they probably got waking up by my message. So they replied me. They were like surprised as well. And then I called them in a couple of hours because they woke up very early. So we just like, my mom wake my dad up and just like let him to go to the supermarket around like 8 a.m. To prepare a bunch of food. Yeah. And before, like one day before that, I was actually talking with them about, you know, maybe changing their flight ticket because they had a flight ticket to the U.S. to visit me in early March. And I didn't like the idea. They just right now live in the epic center, so that I wanted to, you know, kind of get them out from Wuhan. I was thinking about that. But then, you know, one day later, Wuhan got shut down. So I kind of like lost the chance.
And what has life for your parents been like since then? What's a typical day for them under a lockdown?
So after they shopped on January 22nd, they never stepped out of their apartment once. So they have been at home for almost like 10 days already. So a typical day is, you know, they used to have 3 meals a day. But now they tell us, they tell me that because they can get up very late and go to sleep early, so they only have 2 meals a day, and they watch TV. Like they kept their TV on the whole day, and the TV is full of the coronavirus news, so they listen to that, and they browse their social medias all the time. And my mom told me that like both her and my dad put on some weight. Yeah, like it's pretty much like that. Yeah. And they do a lot of cleaning at home. They use the sanitizers to like clean everything. So they do like more housework, you know, cleaning work than usual. Yeah. But they eat less because they don't really move much.
You're also in touch by phone, on WeChat, on probably half a dozen other social media and messaging platforms with other relatives, friends, local journalists, journalists from other parts of China. What kinds of things are you hearing from them about what's happening in Wuhan right now and how it feels?
I am mostly concerned. It's just like how bad the situation really is. And, you know, in order to get to know that, my mom has 2 younger brothers. So my mom's other younger brother, he's a doctor at the hospital. And that hospital is actually assigned as one of the designated hospital to take in the novel coronavirus patients. So, you know, I tried to chat with him, but he's really, really busy. But he did tell me a little bit early on that the situation is very bad, and they have a lot of patients every day, and they had a difficult time to really test everyone and diagnose everyone, because they didn't his hospital doesn't have the diagnostic kits, so they have to send people's blood sample to some other places to get it tested. So a lot of patients in their hospital cannot get diagnosed. And also even you get diagnosed, they don't really have any special way to treat it. Basically, you just have to fight it off with your immune system. So, you know, he's not very optimistic about this whole situation. And just from what he told me, I can sense, you know, his hospital usually don't have many patients at all. And if he felt so overwhelmed right now, I just feel there must be a lot of patients out there.
And he's a pulmonary surgeon, right? So this is actually something that relates to his area of expertise.
Yeah, but right now he's you know, the whole hospital is transformed in this the designated hospital. So he is right now is a doctor at fever department. You know, fever department is this special department they set up at the designated hospital you know, if you are a patient with suspicious symptom, you go to your hospital with the fever department and you go to see doctor there. So right now, for this period of time, he works as a fever department doctor.
I remember early on, probably around the 23rd or the 24th, we heard from him and from other reports from doctors that were circulating on Chinese social media and in a couple of news reports, that there were severe shortages of necessary supplies at a lot of Wuhan hospitals, diagnostic kits for testing to see if people actually were sick with this virus, protective gear. Is that still the case, or have the supply lines improved somewhat since the central government got more mobilized?
It has improved a little bit, but still, you know, later I learned that the diagnosis kits is something that not every hospital are qualified to have, because I think your hospital setup have to be up to a certain standard to do the testing. So his hospital is not one of them. And actually many of the designated hospitals, they are assigned to be one of the hospitals to take in these patients because they are not a big hospital, because they usually don't have many patients, so they are empty, you know, so they can right now be transformed into a special hospital. So usually a designated hospital doesn't have a good, a qualified setup to have the testing kits at their hospital. So this makes this whole diagnose process super long. That means they have to send the blood samples to a more qualified hospital that is not designated to taking these kind of patients. Yeah, so it's because the total amount of testing kits increased because more companies joined to, you know, produce them, but still, you know, the whole diagnostic process is long. It still takes time. So overall, the situation hasn't been that better that much.
So what's your sense of, if you're a Wuhan resident and you start to feel ill, you're coughing, you have a fever, what is the process like? You go to a fever department, how long do you wait? What happens next?
Yeah, I think this is a question that many Wuhan residents is trying to figure out. And even there, you know, they really don't know where to go right now, you know, when they got sick. So everyone's understanding is different. And my understanding is that if you go to a big hospital with a fever department and you try to see a doctor. Once you are there, I've talked to a friend who went to a hospital's fever department actually. And he waited from 9 a.m. all the way to 4 p.m. and like his number was like 400. And by the time he like, by the time it's like 4 p.m., it's only like 100. The number only counted to 100. So like he just left. So you can wait for a whole day there to just to be able to see your doctor. And then you might wait for another 5 hours to get your get some like basic test. And then if you need like IV, stuff like that, then you will need to wait for another couple of hours to do that. So many days, many people spend like a whole day, whole night just from like seeing the doctor, from arriving at a hospital, seeing a doctor, then get some treatment or medicine. But I know that things has been changing very rapidly in Wuhan. I've also heard, you know, I have another friend whose parents got sick. And right now she told me that, you know, the first thing they should do is to notify the community, because right now it seems like the city, they have assigned the community level to be responsible to making record of like who is sick and in your community, and to do the first step of diagnose, like a very basic diagnose with the community residents.
Explain so a little right bit. Sorry to interrupt you. What is a community? What do you mean when you say a community? Is that a group of apartment buildings, or about how many people are in that unit of the city?
The Chinese phrase is 社区. It's not this 小区. It's not the gated community complex. It's 社区. 社区 is more like, I think in English, a better English phrase would be neighborhood. And it's usually like thousands people, you know, like hundreds and thousands people in one community. That's how they define community.
So you report to your neighborhood or to your community, and then what happens after that?
And they will come, and you either go to a community center to get like tested for the first step, and then they will like write your name down, and then they will tell you if you can go to the hospital or not. But also here's people who just go directly to the hospital because they don't trust the community, because community is actually a fact that the community doesn't really have medical resources. So I think it's very chaotic right now. Everyone's trying to figure out, you know, everyone just really hope they don't get sick, because if they get sick, they don't really know what is the best way to go. And the saddest reality is just like, it doesn't matter the idea that you have in your mind, you know, what's the next place I should go. There is like not enough beds and not enough doctor. So if you are not sick enough, doesn't matter if you go to a hospital directly or you go to a community directly, you just cannot get admitted to a hospital. That's just how it is right now.
How are the people that you are talking to getting their information? I mean, I understand there's probably a range, but what do people see as the best sources of information, either on the extent of the outbreak or on specific practical information about how they can protect themselves or get diagnosed and treated if they need to?
So for the past month, I would say the mainland Chinese publication has been doing a really great job on that. And including my parents, you know, doesn't matter if you are a media professional or just like normal residents. And many people I know, they're relying on information like news articles published by publications like Caixin and Fenghuang. You know, they've been doing very great job, and they're publishing like very inside information at a very fast speed. Yeah. So, you know, the articles that we share in our family group chat are largely like Caixin's new latest articles and like Peng Tai's, you know, this couple of media.
How much do people that you talk to know about this timeline, and how do they feel generally about the government's response?
So, yes, I think people generally know, because as I just mentioned, the many mainland news outlets, they have reported on it. And, you know, it was in a we know that the censorship was not that heavy, so that, you know, people like my parents had a chance to read those articles and understand that there were definitely some cover up by the, at least the local government in the very beginning. People are mad, but the thing is, like, just based on my conversation with all my friends and families in Wuhan right now, I would say, you know, being mad at the government is not the main sentiment of what they are feeling right now. The main sentiment is that they are anxious and they are scared of the disease itself, and they hope they don't get sick. They hope that their family don't get sick. And if you are in a safer space, like, let's say, like, if you have been quarantining yourself at home for like 14 days and you are not sick, then I would say people have a little bit more time to get mad at the government and, you know, discuss on that. And yeah, so people, this is a public knowledge, I would say, at least among Wuhan people, that there are cover-ups. What people feel mainly is not like mad at the government. And even there are people who are mad at the government. They are very mad at the Chinese government. They are very mad at the Wuhan government, but not the central government.
I want to ask you another question about how people are feeling about the reliability of information that they're getting. I remember during the SARS outbreak of 2003, I was living in Beijing and reporting on it. And there was a moment when, thanks to some high-ranking whistleblowers who were both doctors and senior government officials, China's leaders were forced to essentially concede that they had covered up the extent of the epidemic. They very suddenly revised the official number of SARS cases from, I think, about 40 to close to 400. And the same day, they fired the health minister and the mayor of Beijing. And this was just a couple days after they had been, the hospitals in Beijing had literally hidden highly infectious, very sick SARS patients from World Health Organization inspectors. In one case, putting the patients into an ambulance and driving them around Beijing for several hours until the WHO inspectors left. And in another case, transferring them from their hospital beds to a hotel. And when the true numbers came out, nobody in Beijing believed them. Everyone assumed that the outbreak was far more extensive than it actually was. And there were a couple of weeks of real panic and anger at the government. You were in Wuhan in school at the time, and I just wonder, what do you remember about SARS, and are people similarly skeptical of the information that the government is providing now, or more trusting?
I was in school. I was a student in Wuhan when SARS broke out. I don't remember that much because SARS was not, like, Wuhan was not, a city that had a very serious situation. But I do remember that we were burning vinegar in our school. So that was the first time I ever smelled burned vinegar. And that smell just, like, stuck in my mind, like, all these years. But I think our, you know, like, my parents and our teachers are relatively calm, and we didn't really, like, stop the classes or anything. And this time, I would say, like, just from my conversations with my friends and families in Wuhan, people are, like, skeptical. The skepticism doesn't show us, like, you know, in a conversation, they won't just tell me, it's like, they must be lying. They're not going to say anything like that. But then, we would like throwing doubts around. Like, I would bring up to my parents, say, like, it's so weird that we have all these cases outside of China, but, like, the number is remain the same in Wuhan. And then we responded, like, yeah, that is weird. Maybe something weird about the virus, but yeah, don't think they're covering it up, right? You know, it's more like this. I don't think people are like that sure the government is covering up, but they are not excluding that possibility.
I'm also curious to hear how easy you feel it has been for local reporters to report and publish their reporting. We talked about this a few minutes ago, but you and I got a glimpse of some fairly alarming censorship early on. It was January 23rd, the day that the lockdown of Wuhan began. I was in Hong Kong, you were in New York, and we were both glued to our computers watching the news. And Caixin, which as you just said, it was the business news magazine that's one of the most independent investigative news outlets in China, posted a story that quoted several doctors in Wuhan estimating that there were as many as 6,000 or 7,000 cases in Wuhan. Of course, now there are more than 20,000 confirmed cases, but at the time there were just, I think, about 100. And we translated that line of that news report, and we quickly tweeted it. We tweeted out the link from China Files' Twitter account, where, if I can just pause to make a tiny pitch here, we're posting all kinds of updates in video and photos. Anyway, a few minutes later, people started complaining that we had translated the story wrong. And they said that the story had actually said that doctors predicted that there could eventually be as many as 6,000 to 7,000 cases. So we looked at the story and there was the word eventually, zuizhong, which kind of means like in the end. And fortunately, you, Mui, had taken a screen grab of the article when you first read it. And we compared your screen grab with the article as it was then appearing on Caixin's website, and we realized that that word had been added after the story had originally been published. But there was no correction posted, you know, for what was a major difference in the facts of the story. And so we were very curious about that. And we showed these two different versions of the story to folks on Twitter. And then you got on the phone and spoke to some friends in the Caixin newsroom, and they were fuming because it turned out that they had been ordered to add the word eventually to the piece, and it was the first version that had actually been correct. So how much are you hearing that kind of thing is still happening? And in the days since then, there's been some really strong reporting from members of the Chinese press. Do you think that's going to be able to continue?
No, I am not positive about that because, you know, like Caixin had some pressure on that piece, as well as many other pieces, but at least they could publish them at that time. But I have multiple journalist friends from different mainline Chinese media have been telling me in the past 2 days that the very heavy censorship has kicked in. You know, multiple news outlets have received orders to be, you know, either be very careful publishing the future news, or even they might need to like delete some of their previous news. That's why there are some volunteers online. They actually now made a list of all the previous news articles from mainland news outlets together. And then, you know, just during the time, like they put this list in the past Saturday, and some friends and I, we start to translate them and archive them. And just in the process of us archiving it, and we realized some link was like initially available, and then like it's invalid right now. So, you know,
so these are already published stories that are already starting to disappear from the internet.
Yes, yes, there are a couple of stories like that. Yeah. And then also, I remember it was Monday when I woke up. I was, you know, every day I woke up, first thing is like, I got my WeChat and just like see what's the latest. And I remember Monday morning, I opened my WeChat and I had the sense of the virus already disappeared. And the whole WeChat just like looks so different. The things people share, it's, I don't know why it's just like there are like not much like critical articles coming out in the past day. It just all of a sudden the whole content of what everyone are sharing are different. I don't know what made that happen, but it has been like this for the past 2 days. Yeah, it's very weird. Yeah.
Yesterday, China's leader, Xi Jinping, held a meeting of the Politburo Standing Committee. These are the guys that run the country, to respond to the crisis. And he said the virus had become, and I'm quoting here from state media reports about that meeting, a major test of China's system and capacity for governance. And he seemed in his other comments to sort of indirectly blame local officials for the outbreak. He said, you know, that the government wouldn't tolerate bureaucratism and officials shirking off their responsibilities, which sort of seemed like an implicit criticism of the government in Wuhan. And then today, the People's Daily front page editorial called the response to the virus a people's war, and they urged readers to more closely rally around the Chinese Communist Party with comrade Xi Jinping as the core if they hope to win this war. So how do you feel about this, and how are people that you're talking to feeling about Xi Jinping's role in the response to the outbreak?
I personally don't feel that. I mean, I think what the central government and the local governments are doing right now is just like trying to push responsibilities to each other. Because a couple of days ago, you know, like when the Wuhan's mayor was questioned on TV, like about their previous decision of delaying releasing the news to the public. And he said like, oh, we need to notify our upper level. You know, he's like implying that he did what he's supposed to do. And just like the upper level didn't give him approval to release the news to the public. And now the central government, you know, they said they're going to punish the local level officials, and they are doing so. You know, they punished several officials in the Hubei Red Cross yesterday, and also a couple of other officials in Wuhan government, because, you know, people were complaining that some Wuhan government official get some masks from the Red Cross, things like that. And also they punished Huanggang's official, just because like she couldn't really answer questions on TV.
That's another city in Hubei, Yuzhijik.
Yeah.
Huanggang is another city in Hubei. Yeah.
Yes, and it has the second largest amount of patients other than Wuhan right now. So I actually think if the Wuhan's mayor is telling the truth, which I tend to believe that, because they might actually need to report what they know to the upper level. Because I think since, you know, Xi Jinping become our president, and the governments tend to have this culture that, you know, less and less people are willing to stand out and like speaking the truth inside of the party and inside of the government. So, you know, if he's saying that, you know, he needs the upper level to approve, and he doesn't want to make a mistake because he decided to do something that that he thinks he's supposed to do. I'm not saying that that's what he thinks. I'm just saying, like, based on what he's telling us, I'm not going to be surprised if that's the truth. And I think the whole system right now is cultivating and encouraging people to not speaking out and to follow this one leader. And I actually think that's the root of a lot of problems right now. I don't know many other, because like, I only talk about this with people, with other Chinese people, you know, overseas. I don't really talk to this with my friends and family in Wuhan via WeChat. So I don't really know what they think about Xi Jinping. But some friends here, you know, in the U.S. do share same thoughts with me, similar thoughts. Yeah.
One more question, and this is just a broad question. Just given your extensive contact with people living in Wuhan, what, if anything, do you think is being missed in the coverage of the outbreak that we're reading? What should we be paying attention to that we're not?
I do think, you know, so far we have whistleblowers from hospitals, from medical world, you know, who is speaking out to tell us about what was the early days like when they first noticed this virus. But then so far, we don't have any whistleblowers from inside of the government, unlike when you were covering SARS at that time. So I think this is one of the major things that we are missing this time. So we might never know what actually happened, you know, if Wuhan government reported to upper level. So who is the main person to be blamed for this outbreak, for this man-made disaster? We still don't know. We might never know because of that.
Well, we'll keep talking. Thanks, Mui.
Thank you, Susie.
Thank you for listening to Asia in Depth. You can check out our show page at asiasociety.org/podcast and follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Asia Society. I'm Tom Nagorski. We'll see you next time.